Thanks for tuning in to Best Show Ever, a podcast presented by the Englert Theater. On today's episode, we'll hear from the artist behind the Black Liberation Space film, Trayvon Coleman. We'll also talk to Danielle Paddett-Majewski, director of Johnson County Public Health. She's going to fill us in on surviving the pandemic, public health in a politicized world, and of course, her Best Show Ever experience. So here we go. Trayvon Coleman is a multidisciplinary artist and cinematic arts grad student here in Iowa City. He has extensive experience as a caricaturist, illustrator, painter, printmaker, and filmmaker. And we're mostly going to talk about that last title today as we discuss Trayvon's latest short film, BLS, Black Liberation Space. It runs at about 12 minutes in length, and it documents the former creative and cultural space in downtown Iowa City known as the Black Liberation Space. It existed for a significant portion of the early COVID-19 pandemic and was led by Andre Wright, entrepreneur and mastermind behind the Humanize My Hoodie brand. Listeners, I encourage you to go Google Black Liberation Space Iowa City and watch the video right now because A, it is very beautiful, and B, it will give some great context to this conversation. Trayvon, thank you so much for coming on to the Best Show Ever podcast today. I'm excited to talk to you a little bit about your film.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell us about the beginning of your relationship with the Black Liberation Space itself. Were you doing things in the space before you began making the documentary?
Yes, actually, one of the artists in the space reached out to me because we had taken a few classes together, and they knew I didn't have a studio space. So initially, I went in to paint. I brought canvases there, and I was set up in a back space. That's how I met Andre through this other artist, and they invited me into the space so that I could get some painting done. So initially, my first interaction with the space was to use it as a studio space.
Did you sense the energy of the people working around you?
Oh, absolutely. It was almost as if everybody already knew each other. You know, you came in and you were immediately welcomed. You know, everyone's working on their thing and they're excited to show you what it is that they're working on. Everyone's really encouraging of each other. It was a really great vibe, just like you had already been a part of the community.
And how often does that happen, you know, being an artist of color? How often does that happen in a place like Iowa, where you just, like, go in and feel like no pressure, no sense of expectations?
Oh, goodness. I have to say never, really. I mean, there's always expectations on you. In fact, before my undergraduate work was responding specifically to those expectations and talking about how walking into a room wearing a hoodie, you know, you think one thing of me versus if I walk in wearing a bow tie. So it was just kind of serendipitous to meet Andre and learn about Humanize My Hoodie. I was like, wow, this is like the same gel of what I've been working in. So, you know, if there are no people of color in those environments, there's always a discomfort, always a feeling of trying to understand what the expectations are to know if you're safe in that space.
And whose idea was it to capture this moment that was happening? Because it wasn't, someone said somewhere that it was never meant to be exhibitionist, and it was always kind of on the down low, more just for the people who were working in the space, not for other people to oogle at or whatever. Yeah. So whose idea was it to be like, actually, we kind of need to document what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to Andre, Andre Wright, who, you know, opened the space to us. I brought my camera in one day. And I just asked if people were okay with me filming. And Andre was like, wait, you do film stuff too? And I was like, yeah. And so I had a 16mm film camera with me. So I was showing him that and, you know, talking about different ways that it had been used for experimentation or, you know, it being an early model for, you know, home videos and things like that. And, you know, he was like, yeah, why don't we do something? You know, why don't we just capture what we're doing here? And that sparked the conversations about what does it mean to capture what we're doing here? And that became many, many conversations about, you know, the way that we want to handle the quote unquote image of the space. You know, as we're talking about, there's expectations, you know, from communities that aren't involved of what a film about the space is supposed to look like. And we had lots of conversations about what that means, what it is that we are trying to do with it. And eventually, you know, we just came to the conclusion that, like, if this is just another piece that an artist made in the space, it can do a lot more than if it was supposed to be a commercial.
Yeah. I love that you mentioned Andre, too, because the way his entrepreneurial finesse and leadership is like a whole art form of its own beyond him, you know, being a fashion designer and, you know, having more literal art practices. But just like him as a person is just someone who is artfully connecting people and ideas.
Yeah, absolutely.
Really powerful. Okay, so the film has gone all around. We got some buzz going. Appearances at the Paris Independent Film Festival, New York Independent Cinema Awards, fancy stuff. What are your dreams for the film moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, this is a part of one of the big conversations. You know, what is the film supposed to do? And again, the film can't tell the whole story. So, the hopes is that it sparks enough curiosity in the people that we can get more of these spaces, you know, we can get a permanent space. That's the real goal. That's why we started filming in the first place, you know. Without anything, we made this space. So what can we do when we have resources put behind it? You know, how many more lives can be affected for the positive, you know, the greatest little city for the arts, right? So let's make sure we keep artists of color in mind, Indigenous artists in mind, when we make spaces, you know. So my hope is that the film helps generate the possibility for those spaces to exist here, you know.
Yeah, one thing I thought of as we were during Witching Hour having conversations about cultural specific spaces is that this film is not only aesthetically pleasing, but it's a tool to do that storytelling. Cause we're always talking about like, we need spaces, we need a space, we need to create space, but it's kind of hard to actually envision and think about what that is in your mind. But here is an actual literal space. And it's documented in a pretty straightforward yet beautiful way. And I think that was so helpful in those conversations, just for me as a person who's in the art community on some level. I'm like, wow, what other kinds of spaces like this should we be making? Women and music in this music scene, what kind of space can we do for that? And I think it's impacted me a lot. I've just started having friends over to my apartment and being like, you guys just want to like cook up some tunes, or, you know, which I've never done before, but having this visual was so helpful. I'm like, yeah, we should do more stuff like that. So I really appreciate that aspect. And I think the more people who see the film, I mean, I almost feel like it's inevitable. The more we'll think about creating spaces and the more we will create spaces.
Oh, that's
just
great.
As, yeah, just, that's just my little, commentary on the future for it is powerful.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, my last question, and you know, feel free to get honest and be candid if you'd like. Being someone who's lived in different places, Maryland, Kansas City, the Carolinas, Florida, what has Iowa City been like for you comparatively as a place to be for a creative person and a creative person of color?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, candidly, we all know the demographics, you know, and to be real, I've been in predominantly white spaces before, you know, and I've lived in the South, you know, so it is different. My experience is my experience is colored by the fact that we had the pandemic mm-hmm. right when I got here. So, you know, that does change a lot in terms of finding community. But Andre Perry, I was fortunate enough to bump into a lot through, you know, just talking about the space, but also through the work I was doing with Bijou and Film Scene. He was really helpful in re-centering the fact that there are spaces where there are communities of color here. They may be hard to find, but they're here. They're absolutely here, and they're doing things. And the Black Liberation Space was one of those. So it's hard. They need to be more present. We need to be able to find them without all of the gatekeeping and whatnot. They need to be more accessible. And by they, I mean opportunities to make spaces like this. But once you find them, there's magic. Mm. You know, once you get into those spaces, the potential for imagining new possibilities is endless.
Mm. Yes, feeling very grateful for the Andres. The Andres.
Of Iowa City, yeah.
The Andres. Absolutely, the yes. Public Space Ones.
Yes, PS1 has been really great. There's so much going on here. It takes some time to find it. I think if it were not for the pandemic, there would have been a faster connection into some of these spaces. But the pandemic did give us an opportunity to open our eyes, you know, to realize what spaces were kept and what spaces were, you know, focused in trying to keep them surviving. And that's what shows you what's really here and what's not. And so the creation of the Black Liberation Space was basically a way to say, like, these spaces need to survive, but they also will survive. You know what I mean? Like, they're going to push through. We always have. We always will. But there's no reason why it has to be under the radar in order to do so.
Or a struggle.
Or a struggle to do so, yeah.
I feel like the leadership is here, just needs more more of that thrust from the larger community.
The resources are right here, you know. There's empty buildings around here, empty spaces. You know, I walk around a lot. There's spaces that could be utilized for these sorts of things. We have to ask the question of the broader community, why is it not being utilized this way?
Well, thank you so much again for chatting with us today and for just being an awesome creative in our community.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Thank you for all the work you all are doing, for highlighting the work that's going on in Iowa City. So,
we'll be right back in conversation with Danielle Paddett-Majewski after a quick word from our development director, Katie Roche.
Did you know that you could be promoting your business, organization, or event to Best Show Ever podcast listeners by placing an ad here on the show? Sponsoring Best Show Ever or other Englert programming ties your brand to a local legacy, the Englert Theater. And your support of the Englert now means more than ever before. In 2020, we experienced significant revenue shortfall brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic. Through this financially tumultuous time, we're producing new digital productions, including this podcast, our Stages concert series, and Witching Hour Festival, all to inspire positive community growth through the arts. Packages range from $100 on up. Our investment in the arts community is only possible with support from sponsors like you. And art supporters are known for supporting those that support the arts. Visit englert.org/sponsorship for all of the information about how to advertise. I mean, you're listening right now. Place your ad here, englert.org/sponsorship.
Danielle Paddett-Majewski is a public health expert with an affinity for policymaking. An Iowan and a UI grad, Danielle became the director of neighboring Washington County's public health department in March of 2013 and eventually held dual roles after being elected in July 2018 as a city councilor in Washington. She's now the public health director for Johnson County. Her current day-to-day activities look like focusing on COVID recovery budgets, public health policy framing, performance management, and legislative advocacy. You know, just the little stuff. Danielle, thank you so much for agreeing to be interviewed on the Best Show Ever podcast today.
Happy to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Can you just give us some background into your relationship with public health, how you decided to give so much of your life to this practice?
Oh my goodness. You know, it's interesting because from the time I was a sophomore in high school, I actually thought that I wanted to be a genetic counselor. And I worked in pediatric genetics at the University of Iowa for like 3 years. It was my last year of undergrad, and I was getting ready to apply for graduate school. And I was in a class with one of my mentors on child abuse and neglect, because oftentimes, you know, we would see, you know, kids who had special needs would often be abused or neglected. And there was a book that we read in that class called Sexual Abuse in America, Epidemic of the 21st Century. And it talked about focusing on preventing sexual abuse in children before it happened through the lens of public health. And I thought, wow, what a novel concept that lets, you know, prevent these terrible things from happening to kids. And at that point, public health just seemed like the right niche for me. I applied to the College of Public Health here at the University of Iowa, and I just immediately felt like this is where I need to be.
Yeah, I realized as I was kind of doing my research for this interview that I actually didn't really understand fully what public health meant, but it's kind of the marriage of health and policy, right?
Yes, that's actually a really excellent way to put it. Yes.
And how do you relate to the actual nitty-gritty policy side of things? Because to me, I don't know, I feel like that's got to be some really down and dirty, unsexy work. What is that like for you? Do you enjoy that aspect of it?
Oh my God. Policy is my love language. because that is how we make big change, you know? And I think that, you know, a lot of people think about public health as, you know, obviously immunizations. People think about it as COVID. You know, people think about it as like disease investigations. But really, you know, public health is about how can we keep populations as a whole healthy. And if you think about, you know, how do we make changes in public health policy? We make changes by ensuring that we have, you know, seatbelt laws, right? That prevents injuries, by having the Smoke-Free Air Act, you know, which has caused a number of people to quit smoking more than just like program interventions can. You know, when you see communities pass taxes on sugar sweetened beverages or increasing taxes on tobacco, you know, when you make, you know, the unhealthy choice more difficult, or as I like to say, like the healthy choice easier and more accessible, that's when we start to see shifts in population health.
Absolutely. What has it been like this past couple of years, getting into our COVID portion of the conversation, the inevitable, with that the health and politics becoming so strangely intertwined?
It was terrible.
Yeah.
It was terrible. You know, you know, have always thought, you know, public health is political, even though, you know, we really try to focus on it being apolitical and how can we just focus on what the evidence says. But to the extent that this pandemic was politicized, it cost people lives. You know, we had a strain on our healthcare system that we didn't have to have. I mean, because I'll be honest with you. As I was watching this, you know, in January of 2020, which seems like a lifetime ago, I wasn't that concerned. I would, you know, we're doing surveillance, we're learning about it, but mostly we're like, get your flu shot, like, don't panic, like, it will be fine. You know, because I really thought that this would be a lot like Ebola, where we would know about it and we would react and we would respond. And I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined that we would just let, you know, a pandemic of this proportion just continue to rage through our communities, you know, and now we are you know, almost 2 years in. And, you know, just as much as we prepare as public health professionals, I mean, most people don't know this, but, you know, the federal government funnels, you know, millions of dollars into our communities so that, you know, public health professionals and hospitals and emergency preparedness coordinators can prepare and respond and practice, you know, mass pandemics. You know, we had plans in place and we have had plans in place. And the way that this pandemic was politicized essentially made it impossible for us to do our jobs, impossible for those plans to be really effective, because we basically kind of threw them out day one because they just kind of kept, you know, our response was not based on science. Our response was based on politics. And that just made it a lot harder for us to do our jobs. And we saw a number of people get sick and die as a result.
I must be so frustrating, continue to be so frustrating.
Oh, I'm just like shaking, just saying it again. Yeah.
I think it's hard to conceptualize actually how difficult these past couple of years have been for healthcare workers, for people outside of that industry. I think we all know it's been bad, but I think it's hard to truly fully conceive what's going on when we're just so outside of it in a way. Can you describe what an average day mid-pandemic might look like for one of your colleagues?
Yeah. So I just have to say this, you know, because people have said like it's hard to conceptualize. Dr. Aaron Ulrich from Drake University did a presentation for Iowa Public Health Association where she said, like, let me explain why this pandemic was so hard on public health professionals. You know, she's like, you had to live it, like everybody else in the community had to live it. But she's like, and you also had to work it. Public health professionals, like healthcare workers, you know, first responders had to work it. But she's like, but you also had to try to change it. Mm. She's like, public health officials were the only people who had to do all three. Where we were, you know, so you want to talk about a typical day. A typical day would be, you know, let's talk about this time last year when we were getting like 80 cases a day. And we had two people doing contact tracing while, you know, we're also trying to give guidance to schools and to businesses and to churches and to people who are angry because their kids are not able to go to school because they're either in quarantine. You know, you have people yelling at you. You have people making nasty comments, you know, every time you post something on social media about changes. You have everybody that you know, just, you know, as a person, messaging you on Facebook or texting you saying like, hey, I know you're really busy, but I have a quick question. Hmm. You know, you try to go into the grocery store to pick up your milk or your prescription and you have three people stopping you and you never get to turn off, you know, and that's, it was kind of like being in fight or flight for like 20 months straight. Hmm. So it was hell. Yeah. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. I would never wish that on anybody.
I definitely appreciate how candid you are when you talk about it.
Well, you know, and I think, you know, and I won't sugarcoat it because, you know, we don't learn well from history, which is unfortunate, but similar things happened in the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. But, you know, we don't like to write about or read about or learn about challenging times. And I, you know, I have seen not, you know, obviously not just myself, but my colleagues go through public denigration of their character, you know, publicly questioning their integrity, threats. You know, I've seen a lot of people say, I can't stay in this profession. I'm getting out of nursing completely. I don't want anybody to forget, you know, how public health professionals were treated, because I am so amazingly impressed with my colleagues. They're smart, they're gritty, and they are always there, you know, trying to do the right thing. And I have so much respect for them. And so I think to be anything less than candid is doing them a disservice.
Absolutely. it really does get glazed over, the actual mental health, physical and mental health impact. And, you know, we kind of think about thanking the public service workers, you know, the murals that have gone up, and it kind of feels like we're not actually addressing the real deep, dark stuff that's brewing here.
Yeah.
And we kind of have to talk about it, or people outside of healthcare won't realize that it's happening. You did an interview that I read, and you mentioned that you've recently been diagnosed with PTSD because of the pandemic. Yes. That kind of hit me pretty hard. What has that specific experience been like, and how common do you see that being?
It's interesting. Like, when you are in fight or flight mode, you kind of turn off your emotions, right? Mm-hmm. I remember it was October, and I kept thinking, like, I think I have COVID. I think I have COVID, because I'm like, I'm really having a hard time breathing. I'm really having a hard time catching my breath. Like, oh my God, am I getting a symptom? And I noticed that I only really ever felt that way when I was walking into my office, like that shortness of breath, that inability to breathe. And I talked to my doctor about it, and he put me on an antidepressant. And then I started to feel nothing. And I didn't know if the antidepressant was just numbing me, or if the trauma, if I was just numb from the trauma, because I just literally felt nothing. And then, as you know, we got through, you know, the first initial rollout of vaccine, and that was that would be a whole nother podcast. But it was in March, and I was a hot mess. I was a hot mess, and I was just very emotional. I was crying a lot, and I had an overwhelming desire. Like, I kept thinking about, like, slitting my wrists, and I was like, holy crap. You know, it was a very eye-opening experience, and I was like, because I would say to my husband probably 5 times a day, I hate my life.
Yeah.
I hate my life. And I was like, I need to go back to therapy. And he diagnosed me with PTSD, and I remember when the CDC sent out a survey, and the results were printed or published in the MMWR in July, and they said, you know, 53% of public health professionals, of the 26 some thousand people that have responded, they said that, you know, 53% had either depression, anxiety, PTSD, or suicidal ideation in the previous 2 weeks. And there was a part of me that felt at first like relieved, like, oh God, it's not just me. And then a larger part of me just felt absolutely devastated that so many of my colleagues across the country felt the same way I felt, because again, like I said, you wouldn't wish it on anyone.
How do you think we build back from there?
Well, you know, public health, it's really hard to invest in something when our outcome is nothing happens, right? Like, response is incredibly sexy. You know, we've spent trillions of dollars since March of last year trying to fight COVID, but like 3% of our entire healthcare budget is targeted towards public health. We need to reinvest in our public health infrastructure, because it is a heck of a lot more expensive to respond than to prevent. But when we do our jobs, nothing happens, right? You know, people don't get sick. There's not mass pandemics. Like, you know, you don't get food poisoning when you go to a restaurant. You don't have lead in your water, because we've done our jobs. You don't see it, but we've done it. And so it's really easy to cut funding or to cut capacity in a field where you don't see anything happen until you take it away. NACHO, the National Association of City and County Health Officials, has essentially said that state and local health departments need approximately 80,000 FTEs. 80,000 FTEs to get, you know, just to get up to speed. Essentially, like our funding and our capacity has been cut in local health departments since 2008. And ever since then, we have just been trying to do more and more and more with less. Mm. So you essentially put somebody on a like a starvation diet and then you say, go run an ultra marathon. You know, and that's what we did. You know, we're able to pivot a lot more effectively when we have capacity that we need. So we need to invest as a state, as a country, in local public health infrastructure. And that's people. Like I said, my colleagues are smart and they have a lot of integrity and they have a lot of, you know, good problem solving skills, but they need some help. We have a lot of work to do to get our systems back into a place where we don't see the kind of adverse outcomes. I mean, we all saw it, You know, we saw the health disparities and the inequities in the different outcomes that we saw in marginalized populations than we did in, you know, wealthier populations. You know, everybody says like, we're all in the same boat. No, we weren't. We were all in the same storm. Some people were on a yacht and they were fine. And some people were hanging on to a buoy. I mean, we were not in the same boat. And we need to fix the systems that have, you know, caused us to be in such divergent places in our resiliency to disasters like this, because this will not be the only disaster that we face that impacts our health outcomes.
Wow, yeah. There is there is a lot there. What would you say either your main takeaway lesson from the pandemic is, or what you'd like the general public to take away from the pandemic?
The pandemic didn't really show me anything that I didn't already know about, you know, health disparities. But, you know, we kept hoping as, as my public health colleagues and I would say like, okay, now we hope the rest of the community can see what we have been talking to each other about, you know, for years, about how, systemic inequities, systemic racism, health disparities, how that impacts everyone. You know, a lot of people think we are, you know, people kept saying like, we're all in this together. We really are, you know, because, we need everybody to be, you know, kind of ensuring that we have the most resilient, healthiest population to basically tackle the next challenge that we're going to face. And so by improving the health of everyone in our communities, like, you know, that tide raises all ships, you know, so how can we set aside the, I don't need that, so nobody needs that mentality, to be like, that may not be a need that I have, but my neighbors and this other community really do need that. And ultimately that benefits everyone, because it was not ever just about COVID, right? Hmm. You know, when we saw our hospitalization rates go up, you know, that wasn't just about COVID. That was about people who might be in a car accident who may not be able to get a trauma bed. That might be about somebody who needed to have surgery to help with their cancer, you know, having to have that postponed. It was about children who were unable to get in for their regular childhood immunizations, being more susceptible to other vaccine preventable illness. So it was never just about COVID. It was about, what are we going to have for a healthcare system when we have burnt out our staff?
Yeah. Yeah, it's been painful to see a lot of the people who do the most important work in our society be the ones most affected negatively, thinking of teachers and healthcare workers. Well, as we move forward, hopefully through things such as art and entertainment, we can continue to evaluate what the heck we've been through and also start reinvigorating and bringing back to life some of the people who have been so negatively impacted by the pandemic. And talking about art and entertainment, it's time to share your best show ever experience. Happy experience that we can look back on and enjoy.
Okay, so my best show ever that I recall. I mean, okay, you have to understand, as part of the pandemic, like, my memory is trash.
Sure, okay? Sure, and fair enough.
So my best show ever recently was January 2020. It was before the pandemic. It was the weekend before the Iowa caucuses. And it was at Hanter, and it was Love It or Leave It, a Crooked Media podcast. And it was just incredibly funny. And I think, you know, there was a lot of people whose eyes were on Iowa, kind of wondering what we were going to do, you know, with the caucuses and kind of like the first in the nation status. And I remember Michael Moore was there, you know, for Bowling for Columbine and Fahrenheit 9/11 and then Fahrenheit 11/9. And that was a really interesting conversation. Also, there was a panel with Rob Sand, state auditor, and Stacy Walker, who is a board of supervisor in Linn County, and then Liz Lenz, who was a writer for the Gazette at that time. And, you know, it's just really fascinating because it was funny because I think there was a lot of stress, I think, in the community at that time, but also like hope. It was just like a good release. You know, especially after, you know, kind of how the previous 3 years had gone. So I roared with laughter and so did the rest of the audience. And I just think that that is such a good feeling. And I am looking forward to post-pandemic, being able to get people back in groups together where there is that laughter, because I think it's healing. And just being able to kind of resonate from the energy, the positive energy of others.
Oh, yes. I never really think about comedy and politics going together like in a healthy way, but this sounds so beautiful. And to mix nationally renowned artists and thinkers with the locals is yes. So cool. Well, thank you so much for sharing that.
Yes.
And also for being so honest about your experience these last couple of years. On behalf of the Engler, we seriously, truly appreciate so much how hard you work and how hard you have worked for our community along with your colleagues. So,
well, I really appreciate that. And I actually was just by the Engler last night and I saw that the Nutcracker is coming. And so definitely hoping to get to that.
Yes. Our song of the week is called Anymore, and it comes from Iowa City musician and songwriter Joey O'Kelly. We're actually getting a peep behind the curtain of Joey's creative process, as the song and cover art are early iterations of what will eventually become a full-blown single. Along with being an artist, Joey is a student, general manager of Scope Productions, and a barista over at Fix, so if you see him, say hi from Ellie. Anyways, here's the song Anymore by Joey O'Kelly.
No, I can't do this. Back to the way that we were before. No, I can't do this alone anymore.
As your realtor, listening to your preferences is my priority. Hi, I'm Kim Schillig. I'm a realtor with Leppett Krager Realtors serving Eastern Iowa. Building a sense of empathy to help you with decision-making and create a successful negotiating strategy, whether you're a buyer or a seller, that is how we work together to realize your goals. If you are considering buying or selling, I'd love the opportunity to talk with you. My name is Kim Schillig. I'm a proud sponsor of Best Show Ever and the Englert Theater, and I'm licensed to sell real estate in the state of Iowa.
Support for this podcast comes from Friends of the Englert. To learn more, visit englert.org/friends. Ongoing support provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and the Iowa Arts Council, a division of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, and by the United States Regional Arts Resilience Fund. Phase One is an initiative of Arts Midwest and its peer United States Regional Arts Organizations, made possible by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation.